Hello kids, welcome to episode 13 of Spinning Yarns with Nick and Paddy, a podcast created by my writing partner, Nick Petru, and I, Patrick McCarthy, where we'll be immersing ourselves in the world of the written words and attempting to be as entertaining and as smart-ass as possible. Before we commence, we'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land in which we meet, the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation, and pay respects to their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region, and their leaders, past, present, and emerging. How the fuck are you, Nick?
Swell, my man. So good. So happy. Happiest I've been in fucking years.
Cheers, dude. Mm. Yeah, fuck, I'm pretty good as well, man. Especially considering last episode when I wanted to fucking neck myself.
Just a little bit of suey.
Yeah, just a little bit of suey. Yeah, but it's all good now. Fuck, man. Just feels like we haven't been here in ages. I'm actually like super relieved to be doing a podcast episode.
Like, we just haven't been here in ages. Like, yeah. It doesn't feel like it. It's been like fucking 6 weeks. Let's be real.
It's 6 weeks.
Something like that. Well, yeah. It was the month. Last episode, you said you were turning 28 in a month and your birthday was how many weeks ago?
Like 3 weeks.
Yeah. So it's like almost 2 months, which quite terrifying.
That's depressing math, say.
It is.
But man, just so relieving to be here though. Cause like we started this like 9 months ago.
Yeah.
Doing podcast. Like, and it was like really exciting. And it was all we were obsessed about. And it's like in a mere 9 months, so much of our lives have changed. We've taken on so many different other creative opportunities, different literally alterations to like whole lifestyles. And now we're here. It's just nice to just sit here and have a Jax.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We've got a lot to talk about, actually.
Well, what we've decided upon, guys, is this is episode 13.
Yes.
Of what we've decided to be season one of Spinning Yarns. I think neither one of us had any idea that, I guess, of this undertaking. Like, it's 9 months of pretty much constant work, constant writing, short stories and poems and discussing them, coming up with fresh ideas and fresh segments. And then especially just trying to live and exist. And I think you get a little bit distracted, maybe torn apart in a little bit away. But man, looking back on it now, like as episode 13 in a long line of them, this feels fucking great.
Mm.
It was like rough and arduous and unsophisticated. But man, fuck, I'm super proud of what we've done, eh?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so like genuinely stoked to be here.
So what we're thinking... Cheers, oh yeah, cheers, man. What we're thinking is, yeah, we're going to wrap up season one with this episode. This is the finale. And then we're going to take a little bit of time. Not exactly sure how long yet. Probably a matter of months. Maybe 3 months or something like that to build up our content again.
Mm. Just so we're not pulling our hair out trying to like meet deadlines that we're creating for ourselves.
Self-inflicted.
You know? Yeah, which is, you know, was pretty fun at times, but also like pretty like fucking hectic. Like I feel like I'm definitely bolder.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
Like, I look more like a testicle now.
So with season two, we're going to bring like a fun new element into play, which is going to be interviews. So we're going to be interviewing a lot of local artists. And when we say local, we mean like sort of Perth area and specifically in Fremantle, because there are just so many artistic fuckheads around here.
Yeah, like you turn a corner and you meet five more fuckheads who know guitar, you know, or do some sort of performance art. And it just seems like a great opportunity. Hey, everyone's always super interested in the podcast and what we're doing. They recognize our voices and stuff, you know, and people seem like want to get involved. Like we've been to a couple gigs together, right? Where I've performed and we've told people we're doing this podcast and people have been like genuinely interested in being interviewed.
Well, yeah, one of them was Yardstock. So we talked about that in episode 12. It's just like backyard shows in Fremantle where like you go to one and there's like music and poems. And
it's
like one of them
being crazy, wasn't it? Hey?
Yeah.
Absolutely crazy.
Right? And then everyone's hell pissed and you migrate in a drunken horde to the next house. It was really, really fun. So yeah, there we talked to a few people and they were super keen.
Mm.
And then you also perform some poetry in a gutted church.
yeah. It's been a busy 6 weeks, dude.
Yeah.
Like what's been happening? What's been happening? So I'm no longer depressed, which is great. You nearly had sex, which is great, but obviously didn't. He's having a really nice time in his new home. He broke his $2,000 bed. That's brilliant. Beautiful. You're now a regular at Clancy's, so you're not only a writer, but you're also
a
drunk.
I've never been a regular before. Yeah, right. It's so good being a regular. I walk in and they don't even ask. They just start pouring me a Guinness. I love it.
Yeah, that is pretty nice. It's so cool. Yeah, yeah. That's the same with like the Nash, like for a Kilkenny. Performed poetry in the middle of punk bands at Yardstock, and that was like an absolute fucking nightmare, wasn't it? It was mental. And then a really peaceful gig at the church. Yeah, man, so fuck. We're here and we're just going to do, you know, a short story by Nick called Salt Thing, doing a poem by myself about my granddad. And then for the final segment, we're going to, as Nick said, we're experimenting with interviews. We've got a mate of mine who's also a very talented musician, tells stories through his music. And he fancied being interviewed for the last segment. So.
He's a very talented musician. I heard him play for the first time the other night and I was fucking floored by it. Oh my God.
That was after the rave. We went to a rave on Saturday night.
We went to a rave.
Yeah. We were in a warehouse surrounded by fuckwits who were stealing our beers and we were like, man, there's such good vibes here. Then we went back to my girlfriend Alexandra's kitchen and stayed up to like 4 a.m. and my friend played music while Alex sung, and it was gorgeous, wasn't it?
Yeah, they were singing the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack. Yeah. That was amazing.
Fuck, which is an amazing soundtrack, dude. So yeah, so anyway, very exciting stuff, and hopefully that will launch us into season two and doing more exciting things than just sitting here and wanking over our own stories, you know?
Oh, actually, talking about wanking, we've got the wank tent now as well.
Oh yeah, yeah, certainly. We have a tent designated for masturbation.
So when one of us is feeling the urge, like they've got a bit of privacy.
We have a capsule.
What it is, it's a recording booth. So you'll notice that the quality of our poems and stories are going to be a little better, like the audio quality.
Yeah.
The actual content is still shit, but the audio quality is much improved. While we're talking as we are now, then we're still out like in the middle of my apartment. So it might be a little echoey, but hey. It's the best we can do.
Yeah, man. You know, if we're nothing if not bespoke and shit. But yeah, so we'll launch into your short story.
Yeah.
Well, let's get to it. The Salt Thing by Nick Petru. When the sun fell behind the red granite outcrop surrounding the salt lake, Russell decided that yes, he was even stupider than the kangaroo. In trying to escape Russell, who intended to skin it for his dogs back home, its legs had plunged through the hard surface as if through snow, and Russell had been so eager to give the roo a bullet that he'd followed it into that very same predicament. It didn't make sense. How could solid salt have swallowed his legs to the knees? He'd screamed and reached for his rifle, which lay on the salt before him, until his knees bled and his arms threatened to pop from their sockets. The lake, about the size of a football oval, was littered with the partially buried remains of a few dozen animals, frozen in the salt. The neck of an emu protruded in an upturned U. Its body was a dark shadow just below the surface. A dog leg stood out like a honey dipper rolled in flies. There were several more roos, a dozen birds, and some shadows Russell couldn't make out. The roo, young but no joey, propped itself up on its elbows and cocked its head about 30 meters away. What was going through its animal brain? Did it yearn for the warmth of its troop, which Russell had scattered, to return to its mother's pouch? The stars came out, and Russell sat hugging himself, a posture he assumed on those long nights when even his dogs wanted their distance from him. His shivering turned the minutes to hours, and he prayed as all atheists pray in secret. And something answered him. A deep cracking in the ground, vibrating the salt and Russell's teeth. The roo went into a frenzy, smacking its head on the salt with each failed leap to freedom. Its panic was contagious. It spread in a hot wave to Russell, who lost control of his body and twisted his knee joints almost to bursting. A fist-sized orb of red light hovered down in the salt between Russell and the Roo. It was growing brighter, shedding light on the structure to which it was attached, a dead tree, maybe, or a mess of heavy-duty cable. No, it wasn't getting brighter, but closer, rising through the salt as though it were a liquid. How thick could salt lakes get? How could anything be moving down there? It came up under the Roo, and for a moment, the vibrating stopped. Then the Roo plunged through the salt like quicksand, clawing for purchase until only its head remained above. The vibrating softened as the thing descended into its trench, an abyss that simply couldn't exist but did. With sunrise, Russell's legs itched so bad they burned, and the flies assembled in their billions, taking him for carrion. He screamed and wept until his throat was salt. Salt all around him and working its way through his skin, pickling him alive. He could only imagine the Roo's suffering. Flies walked into its ears and nostrils and drank its eyes. Just days before, it was bounding over sun-baked outcrops and through fields of wildflowers, a young buck attuning to its adult body, potent and free. Had Russell decided to swelter in front of his TV instead, the Roo would be with his own kind now, lounging in the shade of a eucalypt or boxing for the heart of a doe. He would raise Joey's and stand tall upon the edge of his red plateau, a father and king. Now, there was only salt. And the salt thing. That night, it returned, a spider come to tie down its flies. Silhouetted by the red light were limbs that did resemble spider legs, if that spider were the size of a truck, and if spiders had just one large blazing eye instead of an array. It dragged a dark bulk behind it, like the mantle of a squid. Russell's bones shook, and the salt thing swam up beneath him, staining his world red. Gravity seemed to work extra hard upon him, and his scream tapered to a wheeze as the salt sucked him down and squeezed his chest. Was this it? His doom? With no one but the Roo he'd set out to butcher for company? His breaths came small and fast, the salt constricting with each exhalation. Panic ricocheted off the walls of his skull. He commanded his body to fight, to do something, but only his right hand responded. All but his head and hand was in the salt. He thought that every tiny breath would be his last, that his eyes and tongue would bulge from his skull. And then the vibrating softened. With one final sonorous crack, the salt thing returned to its abyss, leaving Russell and his prey at eye level, his rifle just centimeters beyond the reach of his hand. When carrying his dogs, Russell would hold them firmly so they wouldn't be afraid of falling upon their spines and wouldn't fight him. They would exhale once and then go limp. That was how he felt now. A strange peace came over him. His fate was out of his hands. The stars were textured like clouds and streaked with colours he hadn't seen in the sky before. Was that how the Roo saw the stars? His black eyes glistened, and for hours they stared at each other across the salt. The horrors that would come with sunrise, and just as inevitably, didn't matter. The salt thing, whatever in God's name it was, didn't matter. nor did the fact that no human on Earth knew Russell was out there. 100 million years ago, more, Russell and the Roo were one and the same. Now, they were the same once again, caught in the web of a predator neither man nor marsupial could understand. A meteor drew a silver line in the sky, then fizzled out. The Roo shut his eyes, and Russell followed. The end. Nice.
Thanks, Patty.
We said in the very first episode, we're not going to like blow smoke up each other's asses, you know, like suck each other's dicks and stuff and be like, my God, what a wonderful story, dude. But we tend to do that. And I think it's because I like you, you know, and I respect you. And I do genuinely like your writing. You don't really put too many feet like wrong at all. I remember liking that story months ago, dude, and really wanted it on the podcast, but it was unavailable for some reason. Is that right?
Yeah, so I wrote that one for a competition. There's a publication called The Molotov Cocktail, and they were doing it's a great name, hey.
Dude, the amount of names you've come up with, like, for fucking publications on this podcast, like, is amazing. What was the other one? Like, was it, like, last week or a couple weeks ago?
Quill and Crow.
Quill and Crow, one. Yeah.
Yeah, they've got some wicked. Great names, actually.
Quill and Crow, The Molotov Cocktail.
Yeah. They, hosted a monster-themed flash fiction competition, and I wrote that for that. Obvious, I didn't get an acceptance. I made it through to the shortlist. I'm pretty sure I got an email. So I got close, but you know.
Did they give you feedback or did they just reject it?
I think it was just like encouraging. Like, we really liked your story, but it wasn't quite what we're looking for, which is fairly standard. Like a lot of the times, like a form rejection will be a little bit like that. But then they specifically told me that, yeah, you made it through to the shortlist essentially.
Because not to divert attention from just this specific story while we discuss it right now, but I remember like you did submit a story like a couple months ago and they strangely gave you hell good feedback. Hey?
Yeah.
Like, really helpful, really explorative.
It just depends on the publication. Mm. Like some of them get a lot more submissions per month than others. So some of the bigger ones will get like 1,000 to 2,000 submissions a month, right?
Sure. So they just have no time.
Yeah. Really Yeah, they absolutely don't have the time or the manpower, the funding. You know, there's not too much money in short fiction. Others will maybe get like 100 to 200 a month, and that's a little bit more manageable. But I'm actually reading for this Australian publication at the moment called Etheria Magazine. Cool. So I'm now experiencing what it's like on the other end of that, being a first reader. So essentially, I'll get sent 10 stories a week, and I get to read through them and then like give them the thumbs up or the thumbs down. So then the higher up publishers.
Like a Roman emperor.
Yeah.
And if it's thumbs down, they get killed.
Yeah, decapitated. It's quite good. I'm learning a lot about critiquing. Mm-hmm. I don't give them my feedback, like the actual authors. I give that information to the publisher.
Sure.
So then they know why I gave it like the thumbs down. Most of the time it's the thumbs down. I'm learning a lot about that side of it and, yeah, just about writing as well. Like, it's helped me detect a lot of flaws in my own work. It's been really great, actually.
Oh, that's probably the best part about it, surely. Like, just how you can, just bolster your own work by reading others, you know? It's just great, and it being immersed in it, you know?
I've become a lot more critical, yeah.
Yeah, certainly. I think it's probably a good thing anyway. So, your stories are shit.
So that, yeah, that was for that competition, the salt thing. And it just had to have a monster in it. Yeah. And other than that, there was no other criteria. And I thought, well, okay, I need to give it a unique flavor. And often when I want to give something a new unique flavor, I'll set it in Australia because there's not relatively like many Australians who are, you know, writing compared to like the Yanks.
Yeah, sure. And Australia is just inherently very strange.
Yeah.
Very surreal, like not only in like history and context, but like landscape. You know, it's like flora and fauna. Setting a strange, surrealistic trip in Australia is like, that's a really great marriage, I think.
Definitely.
You know? But I really like that story, man. I love like, we sometimes write, you know, poems and short stories that like, I think we enjoy it being a little bit florid, you know, like a bit flavorful with our language. Sometimes being a bit, you know, arcane and a bit hectic and maybe you could accuse us sometimes of overwriting. But we like it, you know. But man, that was so economic with its language, like so sparse and I'd say like graceful. You didn't complicate that was a funny noise, wasn't it? You didn't like complicate the narrative with language. You didn't like distract from it.
Yep.
Just like this predator and prey stuck in the same horrendous predicament, stalked by something, maybe. And like, just it's just kind of like left bare like that. And the fucking ending was awesome.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah, you're right, man.
I think one reason why it felt economic is probably because of the word count limit. So writing a story at 1,000 words, you obviously have to be more economic.
Was that 1,000 words, was it?
That one, yeah, 1,000 words.
That's nothing, hey?
Yeah.
Holy shit. It's
really difficult writing short stuff like that. I'm finding that I'm leaning more towards longer form at the moment. And when I say longer, I mean like 3,000 words, 5,000 words, up to sort of like 10.
Just a little bit more space.
Yeah.
A little bit niche to operate, hey?
Now I want to go back to the flash fiction, essentially what it is. So then we've got more content for the podcast.
Yeah.
And also because there's a lot more publications that are taking like flash fiction. It's just a little easier to get it out there.
Yeah.
Almost have it like a bit of an assembly line where I want to try and write a story a week eventually.
Especially if it's of that quality.
Now, you said the ending was quite good. I have like a bit of an issue with the second last paragraph or the third last paragraph here. I find that it's really like telly instead of showy. And if there was one thing that I could really like just like go in and change, it would be that.
Which passage do you mean?
So the one that starts 100 million years.
100 million years ago, more Russell and the Roo were one and the same. Yeah, I can see what you mean. I can see what you mean. But I kind of, I don't know. I liked that it wasn't. See, this is the thing. If that was a sentiment that you like beat us over the head with throughout the 1,000 words, like just like every paragraph, every piece ended with some sentiment devoted to that. I think that would smack a big overwritten.
Yeah.
But I think it's kind of nice in the coda, like right towards the end.
I feel like it's implied anyway.
Sure.
You know, like with the salt sucking them down so their heads are essentially like level, like that's pretty symbolic of them being like reduced to the same.
I get what you mean. Yeah. Like, I guess in terms of it being, it's really economic. And as I said, like it's really graceful, but maybe that bit sticks out like a bit of a sore thumb.
It does to me.
Yeah, fair enough.
I'd like skimmed it before and it was.
But this is the thing, right? I feel like you fucking definitely, you just absolutely nailed the last two lines though. I don't know, any hint of being overwritten, the last paragraph starting with 100 million years ago is thrown right in the bin with that last two lines.
I'm glad I redeemed myself.
Yeah, for sure, man. A meteor drew a silver line in the sky, then fizzled out. I just thought that was really nice. You know, like sometimes there was a part of me that was like, oh, what's he going to do with this monster? Is it going to be really their savior? Is he going to push them out of the salt and they're going to rustle on the Roo are going to walk hand in hand into the sunset? It's just really fucking cold and distant and dark and frigid, like the way it ends. I really liked that. And you're right, like you nailed it here when he says, when Russell felt there was a strange peace that came over him. I felt that at the end, you know?
And I feel like that probably would have been enough. And you've got that meteor streaking through the sky. It's almost like weirdly hopeful. Like, you know, when you see a star or a shooting star, you're supposed to make a wish upon it. So I feel like just if I cut out that one paragraph at the end, it would have been just that little bit stronger. Maybe that was the thing that lost me a place in the competition.
I think as encouraging as I want to be, having thoughts like that one you just had, is probably the reason why you're going to only go from strength to strength as a writer.
Oh, thanks, mate.
Well, no, I mean, think about it, right? I mean, it's like just a straight fact. It's like you just constantly want to be growing. And if you're picking something up like that, and I didn't even notice really, I was like, this is conducive to the story. If you're picking it up and you want to do better and you're submitting it, I reckon go for your life, man, 100%. Mm. You only got more subtlety to come.
And I'm even seeing how this story here has influenced some of the newer stuff that I've worked on in an Australian setting. And that was specifically this story called This Red Land, which I just finished and submitted to the Best Australian Yarn Competition. It's this massive competition hosted by, I think it's like the WA paper or some shit. And their prize pool is huge. And
I had like 4 or 5 people message me their stories to read them.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because they just...
Nobody messaged me.
Well, it's because you're a chump. it's because you were the competition. They knew I was sticking out of it.
Not competition at all. But yeah, that was a real slog. The hardest story I've ever written. Just the amount of times I rewrote it and just really suffered in the process. It was terrible. But I'm seeing a lot of that story there that we just read appearing in this, the setting especially, like being in Australia. And it's interesting to see like how my past work is like following me and I'm reusing it. I'm recycling little aspects of my older stories.
Mm. Well, I think more stories like that, and especially set in Australia, and especially with that like economy of language, getting pretty excited. Tumescent even.
Hey, well, wank tent's right there, mate.
Oh,
if
right
you need a minute.
To my right. Poetry time?
Yeah, poetry time.
All right. This poem is about my granddad, and it's called Granddad. Smooth. Granda by Patrick McCarthy. With summer gone and winter's chill teasing the fade of autumn's leaves, when nights once heavy, hot and still see storms and dreams interweave in the sharpening dark. I got in my car and ventured forth as hard rain fell in the gathering cold, to dine with my granddad and parents up north, and found myself dwelling upon getting old with fear bitter and stark. I'd never been afraid of the future before, as I'm so often shackled to the here and now. But that night laid bare was a rot at my core, my sunny heart rarely, if ever, allowed to see any light. I stared at the road, the enveloping gloom, saw imagined losses, all the mistakes I'd make, the ruin of beauty, the dereliction that loomed, convinced from this moment my life was at stake on that darkest of nights. As my broken ride shambled up the freeway alone, I considered my visage in the rearview glass, disturbed by a hairline showing more bone and grey hairs heralding youth's time to pass with the settling of fate. I envisioned the dimming of life's bright flame from my young blue eyes as the years march on. Freshly uncertain, I would feel the same sense of joy I feel now come the end of my song, where the shroud awaits. I struggled a while to figure out why I was suffering from such a dramatic despair. And when it finally clicked, I released a great sigh. For at its heart was love, and it didn't seem fair to corrupt it so. I was visiting Grandad at Mum and Dad's place. A lovely old man, so very dear to me, whose resemblance I see in the shades of my face, yet for whom, though still alive at age 93, I grieved years ago. Though physically able to get up, dress, and walk, he's reduced to a shuffle, his mind of a trance. Dim are the days of deep, good-natured talks, and faded the memories of his wedding day dance with Margaret, his wife. He started burning his porridge and shaving four times a day, which admittedly brought us some darkly humorous heft. But as time hurries by, I must ruefully say, I'm watching a man wither, growing cold and bereft of the love of his life. And ever since that miserable perception was born, I've had to hide my heartbreak in his company, deny the compulsion to flagrantly mourn and avert my swimming eyes so that he'll never see how I'm wounded within. Thus my journey grew haunted by the ghost of a man who hadn't yet given up nor breathed his last, simply lost all ability to look forward and plan, with only blurred glimpses of a now distant past to show him where he's been. My grief at its root was the conflict between who Grandad once was and who he is now, chilling me beyond other horrors I've seen
for my young vanity plainly could not avow what's in store for us all. I feared less the aches and pains of age, more the mists that'd gather at the edges of me. The dulling of ink carved onto my page, the thought of my friends and my family forced to witness my fall. But as my wipers beat back the torrential rain, so too did my spirit of this dreadful unease. My hopeful cheer I fought hard to regain, waged war against sorrow like one would disease before it devoured me whole. Because viewing him this way made me feel ill, this sweet old gent with a place in my heart. For my granddad he is, was, and will be still, despite his elderly mind growing apart from his body and soul. I clung onto him as I plunged through the night, yearning for thoughts both gorgeous and warm, to carve out the darkness a path for some light, seeking safe refuge from the raging storm where he and I could rest. And in my desperate endeavor, I found a way for my heart to unearth all I felt for the man without whom I wouldn't even be here today, and for whom I'd do all I possibly can to preserve him best. My sweet solace arrived in the form of a song I remember him singing since I was a boy. Sinatra's My Way, his voice rich and strong, a warbling dance between anguish and joy that speaks to me still. Long past at a party, Granddad belted it out to the awe of everyone lucky enough to be there. And after years of polluting our expectations with doubt, we were silenced by the music he shared with the air with grace, beauty, and skill. His performance, my mum kindly recorded for me, to enjoy at my leisure his aged dulcet tone. And it was this recording, made for posterity, that I dug up on my drive from the bowels of my phone to soothe my young soul. And bittersweet tears at once poured down my face, and from my aching heart was banished the fright that had scourged me so, leaving nary a trace of the hopeless worry and existential plight come to take their toll. For in the words he was singing, I could hear it all. The unthinkable vastness of a life well lived. A poignant near century of heeding the call. A husband, a father, who gave all he could give and could ask for no more. A grand expanse, rife with all one could hope from one human being who'd tried, loved, and lost. An immense piece of time of immeasurable scope, where he lived as he chose, without fear of the cost, and can in peace close the door. I dried my sad eyes and wiped my damp face, for I'd finally arrived at my family home. The porch light, the beacon of a sacred safe space, where I knew I belonged, however I roamed, to be brought back anew. Dad answered my knocking and let me inside, all memory of rain and storms gone in a blast of glorious fire dearly blazing beside the kitchen where Mum had cooked a feast from the past, potato mince and vegetable stew. And as I savoured its tender aroma, I turned and I saw him stood there, the man plaguing my mind. His rough hand outstretched, his grin unconcerned by the advance of his years, his blue eyes so kind, and his recall to the brim. I met his firm grip. He hugged me up close, clasping me, Pat, his namesake, with obvious joy. Returning his hug with adoration foremost, and the devotion I felt since I was a boy, and I too of him. We took to our places at the stone dining table, tucking into our bounty with ravenous glee. And as I watched him eat mince as quick as he's able, I resolved a jaunt through his ripe memory would do him some good. To pose him a question and somehow induce the stoking of a wizened yet stubborn old flame we feared to let flicker, and in so doing deduce that slumbering within his small wrinkled frame, a giant still stood. But I realize now that my few chosen words were for my own amusement and no senility cure. Yet his golden reaction to what he just heard will for all time stand as a tribute so pure to who he was in the past. "Hey, Grander," I asked him, "do you recall the first time you made love?" At once he choked on his beetroot, spluttered a cough, and said, "What? God and Christ in heaven above, I'm not telling you that. Are you mad? Bugger off." We laughed, and with that, a new peace at long last. The end.
You did it, man. Nice job. That poem was a long time coming, hey?
I think like 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Like ages.
Fist bump.
Thank you. For the listeners at home, Nick just fist bumped me. Yeah, it was really satisfying finishing, man. Really satisfying. Like, I don't know. I knew what the story was. I knew I wanted to go on this little voyage of like dreaming about granddads and getting old and my fears associated with that. But fuck, man, like this, just the actual, like this actual schematics of it, you know, like making it all, keeping all the rhymes tight and keeping it flowing, and also trying to take the listener on like a journey, or even go on a journey myself. Like, fuck, man, it took a while, but yeah, it feels really, really good to finish it.
Yeah, sure. I think the grind was worth it in the end. I know you were having a lot of trouble with like the ending, you know, when we sat at Alex's house in the back patio and we were like working through the poem while they were all like jamming, which was awesome, by the way.
Yeah, we were like listening to a gig, like a post-punk gig, with involving my girlfriend and all our friends while we were just outside stoned and drunk editing each other's stories. It's so nice.
Yeah, that was lovely.
Yeah.
That ending though, we worked through that a little bit there and you took it away and just made it so much better. So I think it ended quite abruptly and the joke at the end wasn't quite earned, but you went back and like established the setting just a little bit more and like led up to that. And it was just so much more satisfying in the end. Hey, so
yeah,
good job.
Yeah, such good advice. It was like, because I showed it to Alex and she loved it, but she's also in the frame of mind to love it, I think, because she's grieving for her nan. You know, so like she wasn't thinking about it in terms of, you know, writing quality or, I mean, you know, she knows all about that. You know, she gives me fantastic advice. But I think when it came to the ending and maybe on the, given the length of the poem, she was like a little bit swept away from it, maybe because she's biased, because she likes me, I don't know why. But when I showed it to you, you gave, like, it was perfect advice. It was like, look, the ending's funny. You can tell it's funny. But there's just no, it's like there's a punchline and no build up. I think like trying to maybe search for him at the end, because I do actually ask questions like that to him, like all the time. Like I remember asking him what his earliest memory was, and he sat for like a couple minutes like trying to think of something. And he said he remembered, I think I've told you, he remembers being 9 years old,
So this man's 93 and he remembers being 9 years old and being in maths and English back to back with the same teachers. And one day a representative of the local church knocked on the door of his literal classroom and asked the teacher if any of the students knew, and this is like, it sounds crazy, right? Knew the liturgy, the mass in Latin. And my granddad was the only one who knew it in Latin. So for about, I think a week or two, he was hosting the mass at the local church, speaking all of it in Latin, doing all of the things at nine. And then they released him. They said, thank you. Like the, you know, the priest was sick. The priest is coming back. Thank you so much, Pat. You can go back to class. He went back to class. And then they fucking failed him for maths and English. They failed to give him an F because he wasn't there. But they were the ones, they were the cunts who let him go, which I just thought was so funny. And again, he was saying it with a mouthful of beetroot and it was just so funny. But yeah, so that was great advice, I think. That tied it up at the end.
Yeah, it was fun doing that. I think it just needed to be like a little bit more grounded and I needed to like feel where I was in the story before that punchline could hit and hit really hard. And I think, yeah, again, it came together really, really well.
Yeah, that's how good advice you gave, actually. It's, you know, like when you're writing, you're saying that no matter how smart the reader is or the listener or, you know, the cinema watcher, they do always need sort of constant reassurance and reaffirmation of their location, their surroundings, the stakes, the context. So like, and you're right, like just doing that, like reestablishing what I was trying to do, the fear of the loss of memory, the loss of himself, reestablishing that right at the end, to set up like a good-hearted ending was, crisp advice. Mm. And yeah, no, I'm really happy with it, man. That's one of the proudest. That's like the proudest I've been of something I've written for ages. I'm under the curiosity whether I should show them it. I don't even know what you think. I'd like to show my family and friends. My family know I'm writing it, but...
Well, if they're all there together, you might just decide to read it out. And if he understands what's going on, he understands. And if not, everyone else will, so...
He just had this idea that in his head, he's just going, meow, 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 meow. Did someone say my name? You know, because I love the man, but I don't know. Anyway, I'll probably show it to him at some point. So as promised, we'll finish this episode with our very first interview. My good friend Jack Davies of Jack Davies and the Bushchucks is here with Nick and I to talk about his craft and the manner in which he goes about telling stories.
Hello. How you doing, dude?
Hello, I'm good. Sitting in my kitchen, having a beer.
Yeah.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, man. Yeah. I'm excited to talk to you, man.
Hey.
Yeah, for sure.
The sun is shining and it's cold, so it's nice to be outside and there's like a nice little chair on the back lawn that you can go and sit on and enjoy some sunshine. Like, what more do you really want?
Sit out there nude.
Done that a few times. Anxiously watching the front door.
I think I've caught you and then went right back to bed. My girlfriend also lives here, Alexandra.
So, we know you write your own music, your own songs. But when you sit down to write, what do you like or want to write about?
I don't know. I think ideally I'd like to be able to write about the world a bit more and things outside of myself. But it's not something you really plan out. You just kind of end up with whatever you sort of do, you know. So often it ends up being a lot more just about myself. And I'd like to not do that as much. But that, I don't know. Like, that seems to happen a lot, I think. Yeah, ends up being quite self-reflective most of the time, but often, you know, often you just write when you're feeling a certain emotion, so it ends up being a bit more about that. So it's a mix of wanting to write about the world and being stuck in your own thoughts about yourself too.
When you say you want to write about the world, do you mean like the state of it or
the
like certain
yeah, all sorts, the smell of it, you know, the look of it. I actually try to do that, but it's hard to plan, be like, I want to write this thing and then do it, because, you know, like when you have an aim in mind, it's pretty hard to achieve that. You kind of just got to do something random and then look back on it and be like, oh, this bit's cool. I like that bit.
Because I've always felt like when you, in your song, like songs I know of yours anyway, you do have a handle on like the sensory impact of what you're writing. Like, you know, you write about the smells and the tastes and the sounds. Like, you're really good at immersing the listener in the here and now of it.
Oh, thanks. I like that as like the ballady sort of thing where you have a sense of place in a song, like in terms of like the sense of environment and stuff. I like when a song does that. So I'd like to be able to create songs that do that, essentially, yeah.
Sounds like you'd be a good fiction writer, actually. You're always told to talk about like what you see and what you can smell and what you can hear and what you can feel, and you want to take account of all the senses, hey?
Yeah, well, that would be fun to try and do. You'd have to find out.
Next minute, horror writer.
Yeah.
So, like, when you are writing songs, do you have any recurring themes?
Food used to be a very big recurring theme for me. Not so much that I would write about food, but I'd write and then often something would come up with food in it, like an image or a smell or something. And then that could be something I could take and it would become like a motif or just the title or something. So something small that doesn't really mean anything by itself, but you can then use it to like represent the song by, like, because it's a bit less serious, a bit more lighthearted and a bit more human, I guess, than being all like, this is about love, you know, you're like, this is about oranges. So like food is definitely a reoccurring thing.
Yeah, so you like tie the, like it start with maybe like an image or a taste of a food and then you tie it to like an emotional state.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really, sort of like you just write a song and then like one random line of the song has like an orange in it and then you're like, oh, that's great. And you just repeat that a few times and then you can call it oranges or something. You know, like it's not necessarily cool. Start off being like, I'm going to write about an orange. You just write about whatever you feel like. And then you happen to mention something, like I'll often just, I don't know why, but just put a bit of food in there because it's kind of like something that's relatable to people, I guess.
Sure.
Eating. So,
you wrote about a nectarine?
I did. I wrote about, well, not as much like, I mean, yeah, I was wanting to make love to a nectarine while on mushrooms, but that's not the point.
Right.
Do you have any goals when you're writing a song? Do you just do it or do you find yourself like going in with a goal or discovering a goal in the midst of writing?
I think I always just want to write something that I'm proud of because it feels really good to make something and then be like, I really like this, you know? So just liking it is the goal, I guess. But it helps to not be too stuck on that because you write a lot of stuff you don't like before you write something you do like. And if you give up on everything, like sometimes you write something you don't even like it, then you look back on it a week later and then you realize you do actually like it. But no, I don't really have any specific goals in mind other than just making something that is enjoyable to, you know, play back or feel proud of that I made. Like,
Well, we'd agree with that, hey? I mean, oftentimes we write something and then you're like, hey, do you want to read my short story, man? It's really shit. And then I'll read it and I'll be like, no, this is fantastic. And you'll read it back and you'll rediscover something you really liked about it, which is really cool. Maybe so much like, as you said, like not so much a goal in mind, but more like just trying to make yourself proud, right?
Yeah, well, sometimes I'll write a story that I know is basically not sellable. Like, I know that very few other people are going to enjoy this thing, but I like it, and I'm happy enough with that, and I'm happy that I stuck it out and finished the fucking thing, you know?
Yeah. If you're trying to write something that you think's good according to other standards, you'll just miss it because you're not doing what you want, which is always what ends up working out the best.
Yeah, sure, man. That's probably the secret, though, really. All right, well, you predominantly write and perform folk, but you've confided in me in our chats over like chess and beers and spliffs and that you'd like to try new things. How would other genres or disciplines affect your storytelling?
Well, I guess, I mean, some way like folk as a genre is a bit of like it's a term that means a lot of things. And it's kind of like an umbrella term really, because like what is folk music really? Because I guess singer-songwriter music is kind of called folk and folk is called singer-songwriter, like that sort of thing. So the whole storytelling aspect of it is folk, so I guess moving away from that might mean that it's not really storytelling anymore. Like I've been really into just doing more guitar stuff, like instrumental things, and I really want to finish recording a bunch of songs and writing a bunch of songs that are more like instrumental guitar stuff, which I've been really liking.
Yeah, because you were mentioning to me recently jazz. Is that
Yeah, I mean, I don't want, like, it feels weird that I'm going to write a jazz album, but it's more just like instrumental guitar, really, with like playing around with the chordal movements and stuff, and just the sort of stories you can tell just through the actual instrument and the changing between different, you know, feelings rather than just sticking in the same key and like strumming the chords. Like, it's a completely different sort of experience of playing the instrument. I've been really liking doing that. I'd like to do more of that. And that wouldn't have words at all, so it wouldn't be, it would completely move away from like storytelling, I guess. But also, I guess just playing more electric guitar and stuff. I don't really know, I guess it's all just different. The acoustic guitar lends itself to just strumming a chord and singing a ballad. So when you move away from that, like the storytelling aspects, I guess, becomes a bit less of the focus.
Do you feel like even if you took out the words, the instruments you play, or the instrumentals you play would be still conveying certain moods or emotions you have?
Yeah.
And so doing, tell a story like that?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, that's what music is. It's just like an emotion kind of thing. Like, I'm getting a cool. It's like an emotional expression in a way. Yeah, so it's still, it's like telling a story through the emotions that it conveys. And I'd like to be able to do that in more ways than just strumming and singing some silly song about how I feel. Like, if I could... Yeah, that oranges or whatever. If you could do that through the instrument a bit more, that would, I think that's something I really want to be able to do better.
Yeah, because that's something we were like thinking about when we were inquiring as to who would like to be interviewed, and thinking about the different artists in Frio that have expressed interest, and they have like lots of different disciplines. We've been approached by like a couple, like a sculptor, yeah, and like a painter,
yeah,
and like Nick, for example, was like wondering, because we write specifically with words. And maybe have like a strict idea of what storytelling is in that regard.
Yeah.
You know, maybe extrapolating it out and deepening the discipline means that you could be touch a lot of more people who'd be telling stories in lots of different ways.
Yeah.
Like instrumentals, for example.
An instrumental song is going to have like peaks and troughs, and it's going to change as you're going along.
Yeah.
And that way, I think that's kind of like a story. If it was like the same emotion through the whole thing, it's kind of flatlining. It's not maybe storytelling, but if it's starting sad and building up to a sort, yeah, of like a happy ending or something like that, that's a trajectory. That's an arc. That's a story, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, definitely.
So I really wanted to ask this question because like whenever I talk to other creatives and stuff, this is the first thing I want to know. It's like something that's really translatable between different like creative endeavors, and that's, what inspires you to actually sit down and do the work?
It's a good question. It's a hard one to answer because I don't know, often I wish I felt like doing this thing right now because I want to finish off this thing I'm writing or recording. But often if you try to force it, it just doesn't really work out.
See, that's the thing that you were saying the other day, Nick, that like inspiration's like 10% of it. But then it's actually sitting down and doing the fucking work, like writing the words or writing the... Yeah, I guess like you can be inspired all you want, right? I mean, I know plenty of people who are inspired, but they don't do fuck all about it.
But the opposite's true as well. Like you can't just, sure, I can't just sit down and be like, I'm going to write something great right now. I think just constantly enjoying playing different instruments for fun. Like I spend a lot of time noodling on the piano and on the guitar and stuff. And from that, you just randomly have ideas every now and again where you like just play something different and like, oh, that's really fun to play, it sounds cool. And you just keep noodling on it until you're like, oh, actually this could be really cool if I put a song to it. And you sort of you've already had the idea and you already got like a relationship with the instrument that you're playing. You just kind of try and just write it down in one go and then be like, oh, that was cool, now I can like keep that as a keepsake and play it anytime I want. And then you can edit it every now and again as you play it, like not like sit down and edit it with a pen, just like play over it and fine tune it, I guess. And that's kind of like the process of sitting down to write it, like just kind of, you know, I guess it's more like just stumbling across it once you're already playing the instrument. It's just definitely hard for me to sit down and be like, I'm going to write a song, unless I have a very, very specific like thing going on in my head where I'm like, I need to write about this, you know. Maybe I've like something very major has happened where I'm like, I want to just like, I have like a refrain or something in my head and I want to write it But that doesn't happen very often.
Mm. Yeah, because I feel like, I mean, I feel the same way, right? I mean, like, I have like an idea in my head of what a poem I want to write, and I might want to try and force it, but I have to, you kind of have to like let rhymes come to you, or let like a, I don't know, a trajectory kind of assemble for you, you know, and you can't really ever sit down and, I mean, I can sit down and maybe work it, but I do need to be nudged by something that I have no control over.
I guess sometimes I do like just jumping in the car and driving somewhere, like into the hills or something, just in a field or some sort of outcrop, a nice view, sitting there, like, yeah, looking at the valley or whatever, and play the guitar, and if you, and bring your notebook, and if you write something, that's great, and if you don't, then you're just like, well, that's okay, and then you just leave when it gets cold and drive home, and it doesn't matter if you have or you haven't, but you put yourself in a situation where you don't have much else to do but work on something.
Sure.
And it's kind of more just because it's like an escape from everything, and a good pastime whilst you're doing that is just to play the guitar and write stuff. So that's another way, I guess, try and write stuff.
Would you find yourself playing something and then discovering, I don't know, a melody that you really liked while you're playing it, and then setting up the record in your phone and replaying it?
Yeah, definitely.
You were interested in it?
Yeah, no, my voice memos is like, is a nightmare. Just an endless number of like, 10-second long, like 1 a.m. recordings of me going, because when you're writing a new song, often you have the melody before the words, and so you're just kind of sitting there like singing gibberish over like some random
noodles and dribbles,
pretty much. Yeah, so there's a lot of that sort of stuff on the voice memos that would be embarrassing to play back to anyone else, but you can listen back to them and you hear the original idea rather than hearing what you've actually recorded.
You just siphon out the gibberish and hear the music.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. I've always been interested in that, hey? Like how musicians come up with it as well, like on the fly. Like even watching them jam the other day.
How the fuck? Yeah. It's like it's a completely different language, man.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, because you guys were flowing, like, just to give context to any the dozen listeners, Jack's jamming with, like, my girlfriend Alexandra, who's a singer, and our friend Sam, who's on the guitar, and Ben from work, he's on the bass, and they're all fantastic. And they're playing this kind of like grungy post-punk sort of stuff, just for a fuck around, right? But what, like, we were sitting outside, Nick and I, for like an hour and a half,
smoking
writing
doobies,
and smoking, just getting fucked up and doing our own writing. And, but you guys were consistently playing, and sometimes it was like just a barrage of instruments, every very rarely, and then you guys would find this flow, and you were writing songs. You know, like, I guess in essence, that's what it is, right? You're like trying to find a song, like discovering it.
Yeah, just jamming,
which I find really fascinating.
Yeah.
It's just so different from what we're used to when we're creating. You can't jam with words.
Yeah, you know, words is a uniquely like introverted thing. Unless you're, I mean, you can write with other people, but I haven't done much of that stuff. But yeah, definitely music with a band is like, it's like a relationship with other people who you're playing with. Like, you kind of sit back a little bit when you're playing so that they can have more space to do what they're doing, and then when your thing you're doing has like a point of like, oh, this is the moment, you can kind of go for it. Yeah, and it's all just it's all about communicating an idea between each other. Yeah,
it's so exciting. Hey, I like that. I wanted to ask you, because we have like an affinity for like violin, and Elise in your band in Bush Jokes plays violin.
Yeah,
does she like, is she like fully present in the jam and then launches in with the violin as well, like while you guys are all finding the flow?
Yeah, well, it's a bit different for when we rehearse, because like, for example, like what we were doing, what I was doing at the house was we were just jamming. Like, we didn't have any songs or anything. We just like, I had the organ on and I just pressed it on a chord that would drone and then started like drumming, and then they would just play random stuff over the top and we just kind of make it up. And then you kind of stop and be like, that's cool, let's do it like this again. But with the band for rehearsal, it's more like I have a song and I'll play it and be like, these are the chords, like, this is roughly how it goes. And then they'll play along to it. So it's a bit of a different way of putting a song together, because the song's already there. It's more about just putting the parts to it. So for that stuff, yeah, she'll just play from start to finish from the first time we try it out. And then same with all the other instruments, you just kind of play held back thing, restrained sort of thing, until you sort of know what's going on, and then you might have an idea you like and you'll just tear into it when the moment arises, that it kind of works.
You almost have like the blueprint to work with,
because you have like a skeleton and you just kind of layer everything on top of it, like bits of clay to build up flesh of the thing. Like, no, she's great. And so, I mean, yeah, I guess like the drums are kind of like the skeleton, but each different member has their own kind of like area that they'll kind of add the detail to. And the violin's a good one because that's kind of like always, most of the time, especially in those big melody parts, sits on the top as like the big driving, like.
Yeah, it's big, unignorable, hey?
Like, yeah. It's a big, like, you know, I don't know how to describe it. It's the thing that your focus or your attention.
The fulcrum which the song pivots.
I guess you pay your attention to that specific melody line that it's playing, and then everything else around it gives it context.
From here, what do you want and where do you want to be? I know it's a big question, but like, you talked to me about like maybe leaving here and going on a trip or going on a road trip, and yeah. I imagine it romantically like Woody Guthrie or Bob Dylan or some shit, like just jumping up a train and with your guitar and a pair of pants and nothing else.
I would like to do that. That would be nice. I don't know.
But do you have anything in mind? Like,
Not really. I mean, I don't know. I guess I just really wanted to. I couldn't think of any job I wanted to do, and I really like play music. I was like, well, heck, if I can just do music and make that work, then that's like my dream. And then I think there's a lot more to do with playing music for a career than just playing music. And I don't know if I'm great at all that stuff. So I think I just
like managing a band or
promoters and shit. Yeah, but I mean, just like the whole lifestyle of it's pretty like. It's not very sturdy, like you didn't get a very solid foundation for a lot of things in your life, which is going to be difficult.
Well, as a musician?
I guess so, yeah, just like in terms of your self-image and other people's image of you and your like, you know, drinking and all that stuff. Like it's a lot of factors that's like, maybe it's not the easiest or the best suited career.
Well, I mean, how old are you, dude?
23.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty normal, eh? Yeah, I mean, again, that's a big question for a 23-year-old to ask. I'm 28 and I've been answering that shit.
But I'm like, do I want to be doing this thing in like 10 years time, or do I want to like have another career too that I really enjoy, and then every now and again I can go on a road trip and play music? Because I think my favorite shows are like playing are just like small gigs to people in like a little hall or whatever, that where people really just are there to like listen and just having a nice time, rather than playing to like hordes of drunk people who are just there for like the experience of going out, rather than wanting to sit down, drink tea and listen to like have a musical experience, you know, like I don't know, like not to say that pubs and stuff don't have that too, because they definitely do, but yeah, no, I really like small shows. So part of me is like, it would be really nice to have another job too and then be able to go on a tour every now and again, like, you know, regional, or you know, maybe do small shows overseas and kind of have that sort of life, but not be totally lost to it all. I guess my answer is I don't really know, but I'd like to be able to do it, but I just don't know to what scale I want to be doing it.
I imagine a lot of like musicians who get to this sort of level want, like, they do kind of prefer those smaller shows, don't they? It seems to be like a pretty unanimous thing.
You have a lot more freedom and a lot more like honesty with that sort of stuff, because you can really just, I mean, you can really do what you want with anything, but I mean it definitely gets a bit more, it feels a lot more difficult once you've got more like expectations and pressure.
Like people actually being there to be like, I want to have a cup of tea and listen to Jack Davies rather than some
Monte Albert. That sounds great. When you said tea and a musical experience, I was like, sign me up.
like a mod wine and a diary. As opposed to some dude being like, man, there's a guy on stage, John Davies. He's going to play some guitar.
It's people who do big touring their whole career. Like, that's hard work, you know. Like, it's probably seems like a lot of fun, and it is, but I haven't done really much of that at all, but I know a lot of people are doing this. It's not easy work, and it takes a pretty tough like psyche, I think, to do it. Like, it's pretty like, you know, so I guess I'm assessing whether that's the dream career for me, to be like constantly on
the live on air.
You know what I mean? Yeah, like that's not the easiest thing in the world to do, and it's not necessarily the nicest thing in the world to do either. Like, it's just like, I think maybe the nicest thing for me is just like those small shows where you feel like you really connect with like a small number of people, and you can travel to beautiful places in the middle of nowhere. Like, I think that's the dream for me. I'd definitely like to do one of those like troubadour trips around the country, like a little hatchback or something.
Traveling show pony.
Play everywhere, like that would let me. That's a goal.
I think you have the capacity to do that. I think you'd have the capacity to like just drift.
Yeah.
Like, I really do. Like, and just
Would you just get gigs from like walking into a pub and talking to someone like, look, I'm in town for the week, can I play? Or like, how would you actually day by day do it?
I don't know. Hey, I mean, there's all sorts of like booking agents and stuff that have different ways of organizing things like that. But at the end of the day, really, it's just like a lot of knowing people who know people who run venues, or just like having the patience and determination to just organize everything yourself. I mean, you can try rock up at a pub with your guitar and see if they let you play, but you might not get enough for your next day worth of fuel if you had to do that, if they even let you play, you know. Like, I don't know, I've not really done enough of that to know the best way to go about it, but hopefully I'll find out.
Well, that's the thing I was saying before, like you said you're 23, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't even have to know right now. Like, you don't even have to know within the next 10 years, man. Like, you're going to change so much, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we're doing, Nick's just turned 29, I've just turned 28, and we're just figuring out that this is sort of something we'd like to do. We're doing it for a giggle, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
But,
yeah.
So there's a lot of romance.
That's kind of how I feel about things at the moment, too. I'm doing this for a bit of a giggle, and if it's not a giggle, then why am I doing it? Like,
100%. Yeah. Wanted to quickly finally ask you anyway, you've sort of already answered this, but like, what things do you wish to enact that'll help you grow or as an artist? Do you feel like you want to, or like, do you feel like that's, if you were going to grow at some point, do you feel like maybe, do you have a direction in which you'd like to aim?
Well, definitely just be able to do just follow my passion about it, to be like, this is really interesting to me and I'm going to do it. In terms of wanting to finish recording a little instrumental thing or doing a little random pop album on the synth keyboard, you know, just for fun, like, because it's something I enjoy doing, and it's like, and it builds on itself in terms of your knowledge of like music, I guess. I got this new cassette recorder and a bunch of fun things like that that I've been starting to record stuff on, and I want to be able to just do that and then actually put that out there in the same way I would my other music. Without diminishing it or anything, just being like, this is something that I enjoyed making and I think it's kind of fun. It doesn't have to be like a big deal. Yeah, so I guess treat it more as a creative outlet than getting stuck in that loop of like, we got to do a single launch, which is good too, but I feel like that can, for me, that can get in the way of being focused on just the joy of creating things.
You just want to enjoy yourself.
A bit more mindful than thinking about goals and stuff like that at the moment, is the impression I'm getting. Yeah,
because I definitely get stuck in the brain of like worrying about doing everything properly, and then it's like, you know, why are you doing it at all if it just becomes unenjoyable? Like, not that, like, most people probably aren't like that, but I get definitely stuck on thinking about things too much. So I kind of notice sometimes I come home and just record something really badly on my cassette player and I'm like, this is like my favorite thing I've recorded in a long time. Why didn't I just do this? You know, so I guess that's the feeling of, if I can incorporate that more into my life, that's probably where I want to be able to do that. But then that is actually what I'm doing, rather than this is just my, like, this is a silly thing I do in my bedroom sometimes for fun, you know, and then toss it out afterwards. Like, hang on to those sort of little bits of random creative fun, and I want to be more free to do what I want without panicking about everything. Yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, that was our short interview with Jack Davies of Jack Davies and Bush Jokes.
Thanks.
How'd we go as interviewers? Was it?
You went great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We didn't cringe you out, no.
I was going to say I did cook ginger cookies last night.
Ginger cookies.
They have no sugar in them though, so they just taste like burnt bread.
Oh, we did so good. We didn't have any clips that whole time. We just ruined it.
You can try some if you want.
Man, that interview was fun, hey.
He's one of my favorite people in the world. I think I saw him perform at Clancy's, where we both work and have worked for 2 years. I saw him perform there, I think, a month into my duration there. And I'd seen him perform a couple times over the last few years, like just in and out of Frio. Like, I remember just being struck by his poetry and his also like just his dexterity with all these different instruments. Like, yeah. You just whip out, like, he's like a polymath when it comes to being an instrumentalist. Harmonica, guitar, banjo, ukulele, all these different other kinds of
drums.
Guitars.
Like,
drums as well. I think he plays a couple of brass instruments, and he plays piano. And he's just like all self-taught, you know? So he's like a genuine savant, but he's also a cooker. You know, he's like a really good friend of mine. And you've met him a few times, right? And
yeah.
He was keen to be interviewed because we wanted to make that segue into, you know, cultivating a community where artists could talk about their work.
And it was nice for us to be able to relate the things he was talking about to like our way of telling stories. Like, there's definitely crossover. There's a lot of things that are different as well, of course. And it was just nice to talk about that. And I feel that our questions were pretty good. And I think next time we do our interview, we'll probably use those or something very similar to those again.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think when I knew they were going to be pretty good, because we worked on them like for a couple hours at the pub, didn't we? But showing him them like one night, I think it was like maybe Tuesday night, I just left them out for him. He was going out with his girlfriend. Then he came back and he told me in the morning, he was like, oh, these are great. Like, these are the exact questions I want to be asked.
Yeah.
You know, like, just let him speak and let him do his thing. There was a part of him that almost seemed like he was, like he'd already been and done it.
It was like ready to retire.
Yeah. There was like, I just
want people to forget my name and face. Yeah. And I just want to like fade.
I fully got that feeling. Like, he was like some middle-aged artist who was at the height of his stardom and just wanted to vanish.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, this guy's 23.
Yeah.
He rules, you know, he rules Frio and it's like with this benevolent iron fist. Like, everyone just loves this kid. But the idea of him doing that, we mentioned in the interview, the Woody Guthrie or Bob Dylan thing, like just a suitcase and his guitar and just jumping on a train and going, girl, wherever the wind blows. I actually like, you know, it's such a cliche, but like, he could do it.
I reckon. Yeah, absolutely.
He could do it.
He's so talented. And we really enjoyed that. So I'm sure we're going to do it again. And I think we mentioned earlier that we've got a bunch of people who are interested in doing it. So you can expect that for season two. Once again, this is the final episode of season one of Spinning Yarns with Nick and Patty.
The season finale.
Yeah, the season finale.
And one of us is going to die tonight.
It's been a wild ride. It's been real fun so far. And I'm just really happy that we finally got this last episode finished, because fuck, man, it's been like 2 months in the making.
Yeah, it has been, man. It has been. I know that's like partly my fault for sure.
It's all your fault.
It's just hard like keeping up the, not only writing material for the podcast to discuss, but like writing stuff you're proud of and you're happy with.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, and I think we've been pretty lucky. Like, projects have come at us like thick and fast. And I'm feeling like more swamped than I ever have. But the fact that we've got this finished is really, really cool. Really encouraging. But I think we've just grown a lot since episode one, which is really nice.
Yeah.
And it's exciting to see where we can go with season two, especially with the interviews and maybe more of with a better body of work under our belts as well.
Absolutely.
But yeah, fuck, it's been fun.
Yeah, good job, man. We're going to finish with a quote, but this one is not from like a book or anything. It's actually from our very own Jack Davies.
Yeah, he just said some pretty things. I mean, everyone just heard it in the interview, right? But like,
we're going to say it again.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Yeah. Before we get into the quote, how can people find more out about Jack?
Oh, yeah. All his band, Jack Davies and the Bush Chucks, all their music is on Spotify and SoundCloud and YouTube as well. Got a number of like music videos out. They're all actually really, really pretty. You can follow on Instagram as well. I think it's Davies_Jack_. Sorry, Jack. Yeah, so the quote. He just said something that I thought was really, really nice, because we're working on this podcast, writing for publications, you're submitting stories, I'm trying to be a performer, and you know, we get like swept up in like the achievements of it all and like trying to like make something of it, money, a career, a name. I don't know, Jack's perspective is quite refreshing, and he said, I'm doing this for a bit of a giggle, and if it's not a giggle, then why am I doing it?